We struggled with what we might do tonight, and I suppose basically just flipped a coin and thought it might be productive and sort of interesting to not get very, very technical or abstract or theoretical about these subjects, but to talk a little bit autobiographically about our involvement, and I guess I'll start out basically with my involvement, in a variety of social change, justice-oriented kinds of efforts over the last 20 years. And think out loud with you about how, about my own struggle to make sense of these things, and trying to figure out what they mean in my life, and what they mean in the country's life. Let me say that I think that there are a number of starting points for this, but let me just say that to begin with, it seems to me that my major conviction, where I sometimes split with Americans in general and Protestants in particular, is that I take very seriously our existence as social beings, right? I think a lot of us is determined by the time and history that we live in, the race and class and sex that we are born into, and that the margin of choice that we have is quite narrow, given all of the stuff that determines us. Right? That all of us, as citizens of North America in the 1980s, are constantly buffeted about by and determined by the mainstream economic and political culture in the United States. We just can't avoid that. Tonight, what I want to try to do is to let you know that, at least in my view, one of the choices we have is to define our public selves a little bit in relationship to other groups and movements. Right? I'm saying we are all defined, whether or not we choose to be, by the mainstream culture. If we choose to commit parts of ourselves and our lives to the pursuit of justice, then we have to find broader contexts, groups of people to which we can relate that help us do that. Individual activity in pursuit of justice is almost, I think, impossible. At least it's virtually always doomed to ineffectiveness. And the other thing I would say just to begin in terms of where I come from about this is that I have a great deal of trouble understanding the language of spiritual journey as an individualistic language. A spiritual journey, it seems to me, we certainly know from the Old Testament, and I think there's a lot in the New Testament about it too, is almost always the journey of a people. And we don't think of ourselves very easily in the United States as a part of a people, as part of a community. We think about spiritual journey. We talked about it the other night in Vespers as an individual set of experiences. So I think that as Americans, one way we are made ineffective and unserious about social justice is to be isolated and to understand ourselves as isolated individuals apart from social movements. Well, I was asked in a couple of settings actually this last fall to think about strategies for a couple of different organizations, and then one within the Urban Studies program that Ingrid and I do, about strategies for a variety of groupings over the next years as we look to the end of Reagan. So that was sort of the trigger in my mind over the last 3 or 4 months, which made me go back and look at the last 20 years of my life and try to make sense of it again. I suppose one ought to do that every 3 or 4 years, but I have been doing a lot of that just this fall. Let me just say a few things about my own involvement in five movements of the last 20 years. In particular, noting also that there are lots of other movements that I think were important going on at the same time, many of which affected me. Let me say at the beginning that, you know, my intersection with these movements was sometimes very central in my life and sometimes peripheral. Moved in and out. It certainly wasn't always central to my life. There was always some other stuff going on in my life. But the kinds of constellations of people interested in pursuing shalom and justice who are gathered out in the society into movements that change all the time. Those have been important sort of touchstones for me. Starting with the civil rights movement. My own involvement in the civil rights movement came in college days when I was about the age of the St. Olaf folks who were here. And it was the peaking, those years in the early 60s, the peaking of the Southern civil rights movement, the final push toward the Voting Rights Act of 1964. I was a college sophomore in the summer of 64 when I went south to what was then called Mississippi Summer, 1964. And that was an attempt to involve white northern college students in a concerted effort to register the masses of unregistered black folks in the hardest state in the Union to get black folks registered to vote in, Mississippi. And there were all kinds of legal barriers as well as informal barriers to black folks voting at that point. Well, I was pretty, I was in college in the East at Princeton. I was out of a fairly privileged middle American family. I had, I think, from my religious upbringing and from nice, good parents, a lot of wishes to do good as well as well in the world, and was beginning to get sucked into a vision of something that was clearly beginning to articulate something different about America from what America in the 1950s had been. Dr. King was coming to prominence. The Montgomery bus boycott took place in 56. I date the civil rights movement sort of arbitrarily from 54 from the Supreme Court decision, but it could be 56 with Montgomery. It could be a number of other dates too. What grabbed us as 20-year-old white folks, though, was the model of 20-year-old black kids in the South who were really a separate part of that movement, not connected with Dr. King at all formally, although there were some informal contacts. This was the sit-in and freedom rider group. Remarkably courageous and smart black kids going mostly to black colleges in the South that I had never heard of before in my life. They began in 1961 getting arrested at lunch counters throughout the South. And more of them, these are 19 and 20-year-old kids, became involved in challenging the century-old, really, traditions and laws of the South. And it was a story of gutsiness and flat-out courage that was really quite attractive to a lot of us. We're all romantic at 19 and 20.
Was that the SNCC?
SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. So SNCC began, forming chapters in the North, on Northern campuses. And I became affiliated with them after the 1963 March in Washington with Dr. King as they got their Ivy League act together. And we organized a fairly large troop of people from the Northeast to go down in Mississippi summer 64. Well, that was just 7 weeks of my life that I was in Mississippi. But I really trace most of what I think about myself and what I'm doing on this earth to those 7 weeks. I certainly learned more in those 7 weeks living in a dirt shack in outside of Greenwood, Mississippi, than I did in 4 years at Princeton, and certainly all of the years of graduate school since then. I'm going to try and just capsule a couple of lessons out of each of these movements if I can. What this did for me was bring me into a totally reversed set of perceptions about who I was as a social being and what I had to give. It turned my natural missionary impulses upside down. I'm sure you've had the same experiences. I was going there to help. I had all the best intentions in the world. And it was clear after the first week who it was that was being helped. Right. And it wasn't them by me. It was really the other way around. I was learning at a pace that I have never learned since, or certainly didn't before. I was learning about the ways in which life can be rich and full and fully lived with absolutely no resources at all. I'd never seen that. I was being exposed to a language and a culture that was absolutely mind-boggling in its fullness and its spirituality, a community spirituality, but that had been absolutely hidden from me as a white American at that point. I had no idea it was there. So I got quickly, although the language didn't occur to me at that point, to be thinking about myself as involved in an experience which would reverse my notions of mission. We now talk about the possibility, finally, of mission in reverse to North American halves by third world peoples. For me, the sort of gut feeling that that's what ought to happen happened to me during that that summer. It was a hairy summer in a lot of ways. It also, lesson number two, defined part of me, at least, as an outlaw in the society, and that was an immensely helpful perception, self-perception. All of my friends, not by my choice, had to be black once I went down. Whites in the South, in Mississippi in that summer, knew who the northern white kids were. And there were a number of hairy stories. We got chased a number of times by the classic pickup trucks, there were some. We got bumped off the road at one point and turned over a couple of times after some forays in. That was my first summer, my first experience in jail. Wouldn't be my last, but it was the first. So there was a sense in which it was both possible and, in fact, absolutely necessary to be outside the law. And that was to be an important experience to me. It relativized the law. It got me to thinking about law as a human instrument, not as something that's sort of given from on high. And that was important. And finally, I learned very difficult lessons about, I guess, not just race, but primarily race, in the area of unintended domination, I guess is one way I would put it now. Some of you may know that after that summer of 64, when lots of us, actually white kids from the North, were feeling pretty good about what we'd done, we had registered, in fact, thousands of black voters in Mississippi. Until August, when three of our number were killed and found in the river a couple of weeks, until August, we were very high about what we had done. But by the beginning of August, before the killing of Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney, which came about mid-August that summer, and really did turn the whole thing around, by early August, the black kids in SNCC were beginning clearly to resent our presence. And by the end of August, SNCC leadership, Stokely Carmichael, H. Rapp Brown, lots of incredibly bright, John Moses, incredibly bright young people, called us, the white kids, to a conference and told us that we were no longer part of SNCC. Kicked us out, totally. This was hard for us to take. I mean, we just didn't understand it. We just did not understand it, and it was very difficult. All of the emotions after, we felt like we'd sort of proved ourselves. We'd given some time and some life. They told us that we ought to go home and do our own work among our own kind. We didn't understand it. There were three conferences following on that fall with white folks talking to white folks trying to understand about what had happened to us down there. And we came to think, we came to think that they were absolutely right. We came to think that that was the absolutely right thing for them to do to us. And we were, partly we were in conversation with them continually about and asking them to explain why it is they had kicked us out of the movement. Not out of the movement, but out of the organization. And they began to tell us about how it is we were the power, whether or not we wanted to be the power. As we went down into rural Mississippi and worked with folks in rural Mississippi, we were the ones who knew how to read and write and type and produce leaflets and make schedules and talk to the sheriffs involved and arrange the voter registration process. We were the ones who knew that stuff. And because we were committed to getting that stuff done, we did it. We went and did it. When the organization needed a car, needed gas money, needed funding to continue the registration drive during the summer, we were the ones who had the resources outside of the South to get the money to come into the South. Right? So it was gradually dawning on these very bright young black people that, unbeknownst to them, they had handed over what they had built with their own blood and jail time for the last 4 years to a bunch of white folks from the North. And that, in fact, we were replicating in a very sort of paternalistic way a racist kind of organization. And that's why they kicked us out. And that's why they began talking about black power. And that's why they began saying to us, you're the problem. Go work on the folks in your own communities. Well, that, as I say, was very difficult for me to understand and took a while to sink in. But I certainly think now, and I guess after a while then, that was an absolutely right thing to do. Okay, enough about civil rights, when we come back to it. Luckily for some of us who were about 20 years old, I say luckily really cynically, having just been booted out of the major social justice effort in the United States in the last 50 years, right? Where do you go next? Well, we formed something called the Northern Student Movement, which was an organization mostly of white Northern college students in support of SNCC. So we began to get organizationally more sophisticated about what you do to share power. But at that point also, Vietnam was escalating. And some of the instinctual feelings that we had, begun to develop in the civil rights movement, I think quite quickly began to understand the war in Vietnam as a connected phenomenon. There was, for instance, the same element of race. And very early on, those of us who had been in Mississippi began asking ourselves, it didn't get asked, I think, broadly until years later, began asking ourselves whether or not the United States would be bombing a European enemy with as much viciousness as we were bombing Vietnam. And the answer seemed to me then, and still does, has to be based somewhat on an understanding of the racial dynamics. A couple of things then about the anti-war movement, which began to grow immediately and was based, in fact, upon people who had been in the civil rights movement. From late 1964 was the first march on Washington in which college students participated, and that was the time when we made up our first. We made up a sign. Princeton was not a hotbed of radicalism in those days. It was a sort of Southern gentleman's university. No women there yet. Then, so we had, we sometimes felt inferior in that way to Harvard and even Yale occasionally. So we made up a sign that said "Even Princeton," which we carried to marches, and we started that in late '64, and that sign got a lot of use in the next 10 years, sort of commuting back and forth from Princeton, New Jersey, to Washington, D.C. The anti-war movement is an incredibly complex set of phenomena. Let me just say a couple of things about it. You know about it, I'm sure. It has really basically two sets of things to understand about it as a movement. One is the anti-war movement, the other sort of is the anti-draft movement. And I found myself back and forth between those things. I became first a conscientious objector, and then when my draft board would not accept the fact that a Lutheran could be such a thing, I became a draft resister, and probably couldn't have done that without having had a previous experience of being an outlaw, so that it was not that new for me to think about myself as jail bait at any given moment. A couple of brief lessons about that, it seems to me. One is a lesson that we were very long in learning, it seems to me, but did become clear after a while, and is about the sort of volatility of young people, including myself. Incredible energy in the 1960s, as you all know, among young people, but an awfully short attention span. Makes you question whether or not social change activity ought to be based generationally, as we really did a lot of it at that point. One thing about generations is they all get older. And some of the limits of that became clear even by the late 60s. It was also clear that even for young people, and probably especially for young people, some element of self-interest in the mobilization around the war in Vietnam was absolutely central, and that was the draft. For at least young men, the draft loomed very large as a part of their immediate future that they had to think about. And people made all kinds of different decisions about that. And we who sort of identified ourselves with the movement had to be very careful not to judge people in terms of, so the whole question of what you think about somebody else's reaction to the same set of things that you're reacting to came up for us constantly there. Lots more to be said about that. Lesson number two out of those days seemed to me to extend some of the civil rights lessons about the element of culture, the relationship of culture to political and social change. Those were the days of, as you all no doubt either experienced or know, of the counterculture, of a whole outcropping of, particularly among young people, another way of thinking about themselves in community, another whole really set of values that were lived out in a variety of communities around the country. Holden Village was not, is not now, immune to the influence of the countercultural kinds of values. It's interesting that, I mean, some people talk about the potential of the church always as a counterculture base, but not much of what went on in the 1960s came out of the church. It really did come out of a set of experimentations that had to do with a variety of other elements in the culture. What's different about that, and those of you who lived through that, I think they probably can appreciate it. I'm not sure, when I talk to my students today, I'm not sure that they can feel that culture can have political weight, that it would mean something, that everybody's appearance in this room would clearly be a political statement, right? You didn't get up in the morning without thinking about how it is you look as a public statement about who you are and how you relate to the culture as a whole. That's very different, you know. I mean, doing a marijuana cigarette was a political act. It wasn't just some kind of a self-fulfilling or adventurous sort of thing to do. It was a political thing. Rock music was a bearer of political weight. That's sort of difficult to, even for me, to get myself back into. But it ingrained in me at least a respect for the necessary interaction, right, between culture and political change. Lots of things to be thinking about there, too. And finally, I think the last thing of many I could talk about in terms of the anti-war movement as lessons for me is to emphasize the way in which, at least for people who were doing what I was doing at that point, the war brought home the interconnectedness of all issues. I alluded to the way in which we began thinking about the war in Vietnam as a racial question. It soon became clear that if you followed the causes of poverty in Mississippi far enough along a causal chain, you would get to a variety of public and private institutions which simply produced and spent money for other things. Right? That there were clear choices being made in the culture, that some things would get done and built, like military establishments, and other things wouldn't. Right? So that there was increasing difficulty for us in isolating and drawing a clean box around any one of these issues. Right? So one of the things I started doing, for instance, in the late 60s was to bring college students who were into the anti-war movement into Chicago to talk to black folks on the west side of Chicago who were doing community organization and the northern cities version of civil rights work, to get into conversation together about what the links were, how both were, in fact, questions of equity that were generated by the same sets of institutions and values that govern the whole society. And in fact, that's where the current urban studies program in Chicago came from, those days of bringing college students into the city and finding out that they could learn a lot more there. Well, not a lot more to be said about that. Let me not say any more about that. At the same time, I suppose then I was thinking about myself as a part of something called the New Left. That is, I was somewhat influenced by Marx or neo-Marxist thinking anyway about stuff, and I was interested in developing communities that had values at the center and so forth. I ran into in Chicago somebody who was real different than that, who was the father of the community organization movement, Saul Alinsky, Tim, who was still alive in those days, a crusty old Jewish son of a bitch who was around Chicago just chewing out everybody, who built organizations, powerful organizations in poor and working class communities and cities across the country, and had been doing that since the 1930s. Why did he do that? You would ask him. I would ask him as a naive, value-laden person. What do you mean, why would I do that? To get power. You dumb. Right? No, I mean, why would you do that? Toward what end do you want power? What do you mean, toward what end do I want power? I just want power for people who don't have power. I actually became for a while a foil for Alinsky in a series of debates at the place called the Urban Training Center for Christian Mission in Chicago that existed during those days. And he would tear up me and a couple of my friends who were sort of representative of the young, idealistic, totally naive, he thought, new left, value-laden schmucks. He believed seriously in organizing for power for the sake of enabling small d democracy to happen. Small d democracy doesn't have any value in it. Doesn't tell us what kind of community we want. It just says that everybody in that community ought to be a participant in it. Everybody ought to, maximum of their capacity, have something to say about what the community is like. It's a form, not a content. And Alinsky was a radical believer in the form. So I became a community organizer for a while, and I worked on and off in that mode, and I really have come to respect a lot of what community organization has to teach us who are naive. About the understanding of power and the understanding of the necessity of winning. These are in the area of lessons here. One of the things that Alinsky could not understand about those of us who were on the so-called New Left is that we were so enamored of losing. We would much rather be right than win, right? And he could not understand that. He would say, give me a tenth of being right and a victory, and I'll take it every time. You can be right and lose all you want, and it won't get the people anyplace. So it gave me a healthy respect for winning. And I do sometimes think that church people in particular have something of a difficult time coming to terms with both power and the good side of winning something once in a while, which doesn't happen all that often in social justice work, but at least it ought to be taken somewhat seriously. A lot more to be said about that. Let me just say a couple things about community development stuff, which has just happened in the last decade for me, and it's different. Community organization built power so that people could make their own decisions and beat up, really, on big institutions outside those communities. community development began to take seriously in the United States, I think what had been taken seriously overseas for some time, that is the building of local institutions, which were the people's own institutions. Economic institutions as well as political and social institutions. We began to see by the early and mid-70s countless neighborhoods, poor and working class neighborhoods in cities particularly, but also in rural areas, where the economy, structured on the older industrial systems and on big institutions, was falling apart for a variety of reasons. We're in a fairly massive economic shift in this country, even as we speak. That became evident in the early 70s to lots of people. So a lot of people began taking seriously such international thinkers as E.F. Schumacher, right, Small is Beautiful, and saying, well, okay, let's reinvent an economy that has some accountability on local turf. Let's reinvent some institutions, since these massive ones don't seem to be serving us, and build some from the bottom up. That's been going on, I think, in very creative and interesting ways, in cities and in rural areas. Habitat for Humanity, I think, is a marvelous example of that kind of work. But there are scores of outfits across the country that do a variety of different approaches to community development work. Lessons, briefly, that turned a lot of us from protest to program. Not an easy shift for some of us to make. Not an easy shift at all. If you're used to beating up the centers of power, right, to then turn your attention to building institutions as a central concern is a very difficult task. And people in cities are still just learning that, I think. Interestingly enough, also, community development was one place that has a kind of movement tinge about it, where it's possible for people from whose identity is primarily on the left to meet those people whose identity is primarily on the right, or who are ideologically. That is, the development of institutions and the development of enterprises is a task in which lots of energy can be poured by people from all points of the political spectrum. And I think that's very important for a political future immediately, particularly in the Reagan years. You can talk to Reagan people about community development stuff in ways that you can't talk about some of this other stuff I'm talking about. And then finally, let me just say a word about electoral politics. Electoral politics has not been absent from any of these other things in my life or in all of our lives for the last 20 years. I think it's been evident over the last century in the United States anyway that social justice movements always fare better under non-conservative national regimes, under moderate to liberal regimes. That is, when particularly in the 20th century anyway, when moderate to liberal democratic regimes are in power, generally you have more effervescence and bubbling of energy at the bottom of the social ladder. Lots of stuff is enabled. There's a sort of umbrella sense, it seems to me, about so that for me, the importance of having a moderate to liberal person in the White House, as opposed to Reagan, is the umbrella protection, the space that creates for the real sources, it seems to me, of social change in the direction of justice. And that's always from the bottom, from my point of view, almost always from the bottom. So that's always been a part of our concern, and every once in a while, particularly when the war was a part of the immediate decision-making agenda, at the national level, a lot of us paid a lot of attention to national politics. But I think it's only, at least in my life and in Ingrid's life, it's really only in the last 5 or 6 years that we've begun taking politics seriously at the local level, particularly with the Harold Washington administration in Chicago. And let me just end with a word or two about that. I think that my understanding of what that, Washington's Chicago's first black mayor, my understanding of what that's about is not that I'm suddenly enamored with electoral politics and I think electing politicians is the answer. I mean, I really do think that is a vacuum cleaner that sucks people in a lot of ways. It's very difficult to disengage them after a while, the electoral political ballgame. Nonetheless, there's a sense in which, for Chicago at any rate, which is a very, I think, it's a pretty important city nationally in terms of setting trends politically, Washington really combines an interest in the first four movements. He certainly comes out of the civil rights movement, embodies that kind of leadership, embodies for me my conviction that that movement in the direction of justice and shalom in this country has to be at least co-led by people of color, at least co-led and real leadership. I mean, that goes way back for me, right? And Washington is a very astute and I think important leader in that way. He comes also out of the community organization movement, understanding what it's like to build local power in local neighborhoods. He has enabled himself a whole lot of activity in the community development area in the city of Chicago. All of those outfits, from the local Habitat for Humanity outfits to a variety of other things, have been given new juice by Washington's policies and presence. And even in the area of peace movement kind of stuff, Washington has been when he was in the United States Congress, was the center of the Black Congressional Caucus for foreign policy and peace considerations, and he really takes that stuff seriously. So Chicago is now the largest nuclear weapon-free zone in the world. We're sort of proud of it. I mean, he really does take that stuff seriously. It's very unusual in Black politicians to find that kind of international vision. And it's also, finally, it seems to me, a chance for us to tinker with program. If you think, like I do, that an awful lot of the old systems in the United States, and in fact in the northern hemisphere generally, are deteriorating at the same time in rapidly accelerating ways, that is, something new has to be done in the organization of our economic and political and social life together. That's a whole semester. Then you need some places where the tinkering is actually possible, where you can do some actual rubber hits the road experimenting with some different forms of stuff. And a lot of that, I think, we can now do in Chicago, and it's sort of fun to do that. Different relationships between public sector and private sector kind of stuff. I always say, you know, that in the United States, our political spectrum runs the entire gamut from A to B. And in Chicago, we are able sometimes to move to C or D. We're not anywhere near Z, but we can sometimes experiment with C or D and begin to envision some new possibilities for governance and institution creating. And that's been important in the last few years. Other things have been important. The women's movement has been real important to me as a man, and it's certainly been important to Ingrid as a woman, and to both of us, I suppose, as a family. Do you want to say anything about that?
Maybe just to put it in a historical context, that the beginning of it for me was realizing in college that I didn't have to write my paper saying why I was a conscientious objector. My whole family is. My father is. My grandfather is. My brothers are. All of my friends in college were. And it was irrelevant when I thought about it. I didn't know that that was important in terms of something that was in the future called the women's movement, but that really was. And it was for a lot of women. And then finding out that we couldn't protest meaningfully against the war in Vietnam because we were women, we just weren't listened to. In fact, on the bullhorns, police would say, arrest the men. Arrest the men. You know, the women were just written off as protesters. And then we were doing a lot of the typing for the movement. You know, women were doing women's work in the movement. And I had not had a lot of personal stuff in the civil rights movement, but I had enough. I'd been thrown out of Cairo, Illinois 3 times by the cops. So all of a sudden it occurred to me that there were some real parallels going on between Black folks saying to white folks, get thee hence, and saying Black is beautiful, and what might be going on in my life and in a lot of women's lives. And so that was a real beginning place for us. We said, it's not fair that we're not taken seriously, basically. So the movement, the atmosphere of a movement, the thinking about rights, the thinking about equality, the Black-white stuff, and then making changes through seizing power was a place for the women's movement, very rich ground for the women's movement to get moving in. And for me, that changed my life. That I was raised so anti-political in northern Minnesota and never had a political thought in my life. I wasn't encouraged to, you know. Our family was a musician's family. We didn't have to think about politics. And it was very good for me to do that, but I did that because of the women's movement. That was like the key that turned the ignition, because it was my own self-interest. And all of a sudden, I understood myself in a completely different way in a context of women. All of a sudden, I became in a sisterhood. I became part of a movement. I got turned on to the potential of the fun of working together with other people for what I saw as healthy change that would benefit half of the people in the country, in the world, which seemed like a good thing. But it was that fertile ground of movements in general, I think, that taught us all a lot of lessons, so we didn't have to relearn or rediscover a lot of wheels. We could take lessons from the civil rights movement, that we could take lessons from the anti-war movement.
Let's just end it there. I mean, the one thing I don't want to leave as an impression, I think, Ingrid, you just said it, is that somehow this is a burden, because it's, I really enjoy life a lot, and I don't think I would be involved in social change work if it wasn't where I thought I could have the most fun in my life. I think that's true for all of us, and sort of live the richest way we know how to do. And again, you know, this is not all there is to life, but it is a way that one way that we define what it is we need to be about. Tim.
As a white middle class male, how do you, what do you think is the most helpful role in terms of community organization? When a lot of those things are involved in lower income communities, or they all are involved in lower income communities, principally among Hispanics or blacks or Native Americans. What role can you play that can be helpful and yet not dominating? You're talking about programming.
I think there are lots of things that can be done. I think that there are moments in the history of these things where particular communities get more sensitive than other moments to the participation of people from outside their group, and particularly in this culture, white males, in what it is they're about. And I think as white males, we need to be sensitive to those moments and say, okay, you know. But I don't think, I mean, in my mind, I don't think that that ought to make us defensive about constantly communicating with those communities and developing strategies. I think there's so much to do one's status as part of an outsider and maybe oppressive community in the eyes of some, an oppressed community, doesn't stand in the way in lots of areas. It really doesn't. I mean, you know, I think everybody who's worked in cities has the experience of being totally accepted in a black community. You know, even after all of these, you know, evenings when we've told each other about what the problems are. Yeah.
The thing that I was most impressed with in your story is when you're working in the South and the blacks said, get out. And at first it was hard, but you did learn that was right. And I think for that whole movement, that had to be so helpful. You know, and then to go back and be supportive to that. You know, and just learning that sometimes you have to stand aside or let those people that you're working with carry the movement, and just to step back would be difficult. Mm-hmm.
It is hard to learn that.
Yeah.
I think men have had to do that in relationship to the women's movement in various times. Mm-hmm. It's healthy.
Yeah. I think we oftentimes think that activity is, you know, doing the action is where it's happening, you know, to stand back and that being a real active thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but we're not used to thinking of this.
Mm-hmm.
Could you rediscover some of those friendships that you made with those people then?
Oh, absolutely. I've seen a lot of those guys since, sure. You know, I mean, that was a particular historical moment. I happen to think there were some kernels of truth that are sort of beyond that moment and that and what happened there. But lots of things, all of those guys in SNCC were through Chicago in the 83 mayoral election working for Washington. We worked with all of them. And it was really a sort of reunion time for lots of those folks. You know, I think part of a part of our problem as Americans is that we are ahistorical. We don't think of ourselves as part of history. And the trick in doing social change is to figure out what the possibilities are at any given historical moment. And they're going to be different in 1987 than they were in 1985. They're just different. And we need to sort of get used to reading the historical moment together and figuring out what it is we do together. I mean, Reagan's got only a year and a half left, and we ought to be all concentrating our thoughts about, well, okay, what do we do next? I mean, what do we do with, now that that's the case? What do we do now that the thing's slipping in Washington a little bit with the Iran thing? What possibilities does that open up? You know, how can we be smart about where the openings are? Who are the possible constituencies we can rope into this? Right, various points. I mean, Holden thinks about that. Holden thinks about ways that, you know, one, this is a good place for thinking about where people actually are at a given moment in history.
I just remembered now that historically we used to argue in the anti-war movement about whether it was okay to have women's caucuses that would pull out like once a week or, you know, just at the beginning of the women's movement, whether it was okay to be doing sort of self-help consciousness-raising groups for women. And a lot of men in particular argued real angrily that we should not waste time that way. What we should be doing is doing that typing. And we somehow had a sense that our life depended on our self-preservation. I mean, it was a real clear sense that it was terribly important work for us to be doing. And of course, it was, because we became much more confident leaders then. And we contributed a lot more common sense, strength, self-confidence, all kinds of things to the anti-war movement and to a variety of other areas. I mean, a lot of the people that I remember now having those arguments with back then are now people that are terrific leaders in Chicago in a variety of ways. And to wonder whether it was okay for us to do that. We were so tentative at the beginning, and we were so easily made defensive. And, you know, when I look back in that historical moment, it seems comical, but that's where it was then. That was that. We also went through a period of about 3 years where I wore literally nothing but blue work shirts and blue jeans. And that was my political statement. Everybody, all the women I knew, that's what they wore. It made life simple and cheap.
But that was just protest against?
Against having to be pretty and have being judged by your body and your appearance and all that stuff. Just be plain and sensible and wear the simplest thing. If we all wore the same thing, then you couldn't pit one against another and compete. And it was good. It was good for us, and we saved a lot of time and money that way, and we felt good about each other. It wasn't a bad thing. In the summertime, we wore blue jean cutoffs.
Yeah.
In the 60s and 70s, it seems as if there were a larger percentage of people that were involved in peace movements and justice issues. Why do you think that people are losing interest today and there's not as many people?
Well, I think we've had 6 years of Ronald Reagan. I mean, I'm not being nonpartisan and objective up here tonight. I think we're paying for 6 years of Ronald Reagan. But I don't think that things are as dead as the mass media, for instance, would have us believe out there. There's an awful lot of ferment. A lot of it's localized. A lot of it's not visible at a national level. A lot of it goes in and out the ears of the mass media because they're not attuned to it at all. But the peace movement isn't dead in this country. Freeze movement isn't dead in this country. Local initiatives like the community development stuff is not dead in this country. Movements of people of color are not dead in this country. A lot of local political stuff is not dead in this country. You know, there's an awful lot of building blocks out there. But I do think that one pays for the way in which the agenda gets set at a national level. And Reagan's had 6 years to set the agenda at the public and national level. You know, it's one little story. One of the things, we have some friends in Chicago, in the Washington administration, who, by a bunch of quirks, have made contacts with the Italian Christian Democrats and the Italian communists who are allied in Italy and rule vast sections of Italy. They are on the lookout for what they call a non-Reagan America. they know, the Italians know, I mean, and I think they're typical of lots of places around the world, that there is another America, and that Reagan's out in 88, and that something else needs to happen on the international front, in foreign policy and in anti-nuclear stuff particularly, as well as international economic order, to make some of the North-South issues in particular come clearer. So they have sent delegations constantly back and forth to Chicago. It was the Italian government back and forth to Chicago, Chicago being viewed as an alternative to Reagan, right, at this point, which it is. I mean, so there's a lot of room to move.
And Harold Washington goes to Italy.
Yeah, tours Italy. Talks not only with the Pope, but the rulers of the major parties over there. And is received as a major leader and a representative of an America that's not Reagan's America.
Is there such an Italian number in Chicago that
builds up on? To some degree. We use it locally, politically, to try to get a few of the Italian folks to recognize the fact that they're not going to die with a black mayor. It's tough. Bear?
Yeah, I guess I would just like to hear a little bit more about what you said when you were closing about, you know, why do you do it? I mean, you said that when you first went down to the South, you were sort of coming out of a, like you said, nice religious parents, and you were instilled with that sense of sort of doing a missionary kind of sense. But you've obviously stayed in there and have changed that perspective to some degree. But you know, you said it was what do you get out of it? Why do you stay in there?
Let me just clarify that a little bit. I didn't mean missionary in that. Those were my non-church years. I mean, I went away to college to drop the church stuff, and I really did pretty thoroughly for a number of years, and sort of became missionary is a word that I put on where I was mentally.
That's the way I took it.
Then, yeah.
Jody also was the editor of the Princeton Daily newspaper, and he was the first, he wrote the first Ivy League editorial against the war, which I think he should be praised for. He saw it before Harvard and before Yale.
That's right. And then we actually organized Harvard, Yale, and the rest of the Ivy League to come out with a second with a big editorial on the front page in every Ivy League paper against the war. Big splash in front page of the New York Times.
What year was that?
Early 65.
Wow.
I have to say that the church re-entered my life in an important way. Not the institutional church people. I began to see by the late 60s and early 70s that a lot of the people that I had the most respect for, that seemed to be hanging in there with the most humane values, that I think was at the center of the best of the movement, and from religious backgrounds. And we're working out of religious communities, not we're religious individuals. We're working out of religious communities, both Catholic and Protestant, and also Jewish. And I then rethought my relationship to my own religious community, and certainly have come to think about some core values, which I now am not ashamed to call religious and Christian, as part of what sustains me and what I do now. Although I think I could do what I'm doing with not much difference out of a humanist perspective. And it is partly because it's fun. I mean, partly I think that living a straight life in the United States these days, as most everybody at Holden must be aware of, people would be here, is a terrifically constricting prospect. That the more we become dominated by huge hierarchically organized institutions in whatever sector you're dealing with, whether private sector, public sector, not-for-profit. And the more you get onto that ladder game, the more difficult it is to find a human core to oneself and to connect with community in a humane way, I think. So I think that, for me, a humane and rich life needs to be outside of those major institutions, at least not dependent on them for my well-being. And I suspect that that's why I feel connected with lots of people at Holden, because lots of people at Holden are sort of playing with those ideas too.
It's probably a good question, but I'm probably kind of an obvious question, but I drool when I hear the experiences you were able to cut your teeth on, things that I read in history books all through college, you know, maybe you were able to.
You feel ancient,
that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just, you've got good knees too, and he's got bad ones, so. So no, advantage saying, to youth, Jenny.
Okay. Yeah, I had a brother and sister who are in their 30s now, and I know that I'm sure that my perspectives were changed radically because of the family pull between their experience and the anti-war movement and my parents who were World War II vets, and et cetera, et cetera. I mean, how do you get your feet wet? How do you get started?
Well, I really do think it's a choice that's not impossible to make today either. You're going to Central America next week. I mean, the church involvement in issues like foreign policy, Central America particularly, was nowhere to be seen when I was coming up. I think you're making the choices that are available at this moment in history in the same way that I was trying to then. I mean, there were lots and lots, by far the majority of people who were immigrants in my age who did not do what we did. I mean, I'm not going to judge people for not doing that, but it's not something that sort of happens to you because you're born at a particular point in time. It's something, it seems to me the opportunities are still there, and they change in form, and you need to connect yourself to them as you're doing. I mean, I would be surprised if your trip to El Salvador and Nicaragua was not in some way a life-changing trip, to be at least something that you're going to have to work real hard with, hopefully in community, to integrate into your life, into who you are. That's just...
I'm still thinking about your comments about social justice starting from the bottom up, and that it means that what our place oftentimes is to do is to stand back. And what, but that's an active standing back as opposed to a passive standing back. Can you explain what you see that as meaning, you know, in concrete terms and, you know, for example, and I guess especially in relation to the current time, what that would mean for us today, to let social justice happen from the bottom up and for us to...
Well, that's really an oversimplification, although I think it's an important part of the formula. I think it's really important to think about how change happens if you're committed to justice. Partly, it seems to me, if you work with institutions, you know that change dynamics have a sort of inside-outside character to them, right? I mean, I think that's one of the explanations for why it is that moderate to liberal democratic regimes nationally are more friendly to movement and effervescent activity at the bottom of society. That there's an inside-outside dynamic, that the federal government, in fact, is there to be hustled, right? The war on poverty was a big pot of money, not nearly as big as it ought to have been, but it's a lot bigger than we've seen in the last 10 years, for organizations to deal with. Social change in Chicago happens inside out. Washington can't do it from the top. The mayor can't do it from the top. He needs pressure from the outside and from the bottom to be able to do what he wants to do. Otherwise, he can't do it. So I think there's that, you know, so I had to think about, for instance, did I want to go inside City Hall when Washington won 4 years ago and work inside there and work in that administration, like a department or something? And I thought about it for a while, and I thought, no, at least not now. I would rather be outside where it's possible to put some pressure on friends. I mean, even friends inside need pressure to be able to do something, right? Elmer can't do stuff in this village, some of the stuff he wants to do, because of other pressures he's got on him, without pressure from people in the village to do what he would like to do anyway.
Can you give an example of Washington, an issue?
Washington would like to redistribute find ways to get money to neighborhoods, right, in a shrinking budget. One way to do that is to get money from downtown developers who are building buildings just constantly in Chicago, to leverage a part of that money and put it in community, in neighborhoods. He couldn't do that because he needs the support of downtown business until there was enough pressure put on downtown business by angry neighborhoods to make that the politically wise and understandable thing for him to do, even though he wanted to do it. That's always the way it is. We got to draw this to an end.
So, do you support the neighborhoods? You get behind the neighborhoods, and they have.
Sure, strategize this inside outside business. I mean, that's one of the things we're doing in Chicago.
Thank you.